We're talking with an editorial cartoonist about illustrating the year that was. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Of course, the pandemic, but also a year of bitter political polarization and anger. Face masks transformed from a public health tool into a political hot potato, and finding things to laugh at was so much harder. What editorial cartoons resonated with you in 2020? What do you want to ask a cartoonist about their process? It's 800-642-1234. Phil Hands is editorial cartoonist for the Wisconsin State Journal. He is the only cartoonist on the staff of a newspaper in our state. And we're looking back at some of his work this year. You can find a slideshow of his pieces over on the Morning Show page at WPR.org. Phil, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks for having me back on. I really enjoy being on your show.
Well, phew, here we are, last day. Are ideas still coming to you, or are you, like, running on empty?
Oh, no, I'm never running on empty. No, 2020 is the gift that won't stop giving. I'm actually looking forward to a new year and new political figures to draw. You know, I'm going to spend a lot more time drawing crazy Uncle Joe Biden and less time drawing Donald Trump. So it'll be good for me. And I'm the new year always feels like it invigorates me and I can sort of reset and get back to normal. I end up doing a lot of holiday, themed cartoons at the end of the year. And it is nice to just sort of take a little break, refresh, and get back to it come January 1st.
Well, yeah, you usually sing these funny political lyrics set to Christmas songs. I think you broke out in song last year. Are you still feeling it?
We tried to figure out how to do that again this year, but doing it virtually, over Zoom seemed a little too complicated. So we didn't end up doing that this year. But as soon as we can, we will be singing again Christmas carols with political lyrics to them, because that's one of my favorite things to do.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned President-elect Joe Biden and drawing him. Are you ready to draw him a lot?
Yes. Yeah, so I got some practice with him over the last year and a half since he sort of entered. I think I drew him a couple of times back when he was vice president too. So he's the face that, like, we all know Joe Biden. I know Joe Biden. I'm looking forward to a politician who, he says a lot of he's gaffe prone, so he'll say some dumb things over the next 4 years. I'm sure he'll make some mistakes, and I will exploit those mistakes, and I'll have the joy of doing it without, like, the whole threat of our democracy maybe being in danger.
In peril.
With Donald Trump.
Do you get, like, muscle memory when you draw presidents over and over, or do their looks change over time for you?
I'm always sort of readjusting how I draw someone. If I notice something else I want to highlight, even with, 4 years of drawing Donald Trump on a regular basis, I sort of changed things up in the last, the last drawing of him is different than the first drawing was. It just evolves over time. I know with Trump, at one point I decided to make his comb over very structural. So I really looked at how the comb over worked and tried to just actually caricature how his hair moved in an even more ridiculous way than it does in real life. And so I know that with Uncle Joe, it'll evolve over the next 4 years. And the way I draw him now will be different than the way I'm drawing him in 4 years.
You were really into ears. I think you were really into ears with Obama. Wasn't that right?
Oh yeah. Well, Obama had big hubcap ears. He was pretty good looking guy, without a whole lot you could sort of make fun of on his face, except he had these ears that stuck out way too far on either side of his head. So that was sort of fun to make fun of. And Joe Biden's got that, it's hard to draw Joe Biden when he's not smiling. If he looks angry, he doesn't look the same. He's got to have that really big, ridiculous grin to make it really look like Joe Biden, in my opinion.
I'm going to reintroduce you here. We're talking with Phil Hands, editorial cartoonist for the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about his work this year. What did you make of the political cartoons you saw this year? Are there any ones you cut out or printed or that you keep with you, maybe that you've shared? Join in. Tell us about it. 800-642-1234. Phil, I know you work backwards and you do your last frame first on your comic strips. When you did that last frame on some of your comic strips this year. I kept thinking to myself, did you say to yourself, how am I going to work up to this? How do I lead up to this one? Was that more difficult?
No, that's just sort of a standard technique that I use, because if you know, the last frame of, if you're doing like a four panel cartoon, the last frame is what you're trying to say,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so you just have to figure out how you get to say it. And that's just the part of the cartoon that's actually just flat out writing, you know, where you have to just write your way into the solution. And so no, that's not usually difficult, for me. I mean, every once in a while I'll come up with a premise for something and I have to figure out the ending, but usually it starts with what is the message? What is the point? And then how do you get there?
Well, let's look at one of your cartoons. Talk about one of your cartoons. You depict the president as a dumpster fire. So it's provocative. And Joe Biden on a billboard that says, average Joe. Can you talk a little bit about the messaging behind this cartoon?
Yeah, well, I think that cartoon in particular, just sort of, I think I did that right around the time of the conventions. And it just felt like, you know, Joe Biden was a boring, not very exciting, inspirational person. And I think I had somebody in that cartoon saying he's not very exciting. He's rather boring. And I think Uncle Sam says boring sounds great after dealing with 4 years of this dumpster fire that has been the Trump administration. And I drew Trump, as a dumpster fire, which seems pretty evocative for 2020. But yeah, I think that sort of just sums up the entire year for me. It's been, or the entire 4 years for me. There's been so much contention, and everything is an outrage, and everything has been explosive and difficult with this president, that somebody who's a boring old politician just sounds just great to me, even as a political cartoonist.
Even as a political cartoonist. Let's take a call now. Reggie is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Reggie.
Hi,
what would you like to say?
I have a niece who is on the spectrum. She's 8 or 9. I think she's just turned 9. And lately she's really focused, probably last couple of years, she's really focused on like cartoon comic strip type drawing. I was wondering, as it pertains to like materials, as it pertains to like classes or anything you can help with, how can I encourage her to continue drawing in that particular fashion and to help her progress in it?
Oh, Reggie, thank you so much. So a niece with autism who's really gravitating toward comics, maybe perhaps toward graphic novels. Phil, what would you say to nurture that?
I would say definitely get some Calvin and Hobbes comic strips in front of her, because the guy that drew Calvin and Hobbes is probably the greatest comic strip artist of all time. And so he's my inspiration for the work that I do. And I think he's inspired most, a lot of cartoonists nowadays. So that would be the first reference that I would use. And then, you know, I'm always surprised how many, community centers or organizations out there are offering, you know, sort of comics or manga or comic classes. I've taught them in the past, actually, in the Madison area.
Libraries, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would look into that and see if there was something in our area that you could get her signed up for. And then, you know, YouTube can be there. You can find all sorts of interesting ways of and drawing instruction on YouTube. And I've done some instructional videos on YouTube or on Facebook videos. So, there's a whole lot of resources out there to figure out how to improve your drawing skills and to get into comics nowadays. So,
oh, those YouTube videos are all the rage with my kids. They're sketching out baby Yoda as a Christmas. It's just so funny, and they're doing it step by step. It looks so great. We have Phil Hands with us, editorial cartoonist at the Wisconsin State Journal. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we look back at editorial cartoons this year. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In October, Washington Post editorial cartoonist Tom Tolles retired after a half century of cartooning, 18 years at the Post. The last words on his final cartoon read, "Old cartoonists never die. They merely disappear into the eraser crumbs." And his last frame is his empty chair, his desk and a light shining on one pen that rests in the center alone. What editorial cartoon stayed with you this year? Do you keep up on The Onion's editorial cartoon coverage? Do you find them funny or engaging? Do you have an idea for a great political cartoon? Share with us, 800-642-1234. Phil Hands is editorial cartoonist for the Wisconsin State Journal, and we're looking back at his year in illustrations. I'm wondering, you know, the spread of the pandemic and all of these months, how did you capture the pandemic through your illustrations?
You know, I had to draw a lot of masks this year, which as much as I support wearing masks for people, I'm opposed to it for cartoon characters because there's so much emotion in the mouth and the nose that gets covered up by a mask. It makes it really hard to draw characters.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
So, yeah, I ended up drawing a lot of masks this year, and I ended up drawing the actual virus quite a bit. And you know, you have to try to figure out how to caricature this microscopic virus. Usually it sort of ends up with like a sort of like a bowling ball with spikes on it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I understand that you don't feel really great at drawing these inanimate objects. So was that a challenge for you?
Oh, that is a challenge. Yeah. So my favorite thing to draw are like big expressive faces, preferably not covered up by masks, and you know, very sort of outlandish hand gestures. So anytime I have to draw a thing that isn't alive, I guess a virus is alive, but anything that's sort of inanimate, it always challenges me because I have to try. I always try and add, you know, interest in life to everything I try and draw, and so it's always a bit of a challenge with something like a virus that just sort of supposedly just sort of sits still. But you know, I started using it, you know, how you know, you see these old school cartoons, it'll have, you know, if somebody gets knocked on the head, they'll have stars around their
mm-hmm.
head. I started using the virus to sort of like, I would replace the stars with viruses to show that people were contagious or infected. So that was sort of a fun trick to do, especially when I drew them in crowded bars.
Many of your comics also feature just everyday people. And I'm wondering where you get your ideas for, you know, drawing, you know, people in bars or just, you know, people on the street.
I try and in the days where I used to be out and about a lot more, I would
well, once would, upon a time,
once when upon I... a time, yeah. You know, you try and look and find characters, you know, real people on the street that sort of inspire you to look like people, because, you know, when I draw a generic character, which I do a lot, I'll just sort of draw, you know, what a woman looks like or what a man looks like. They get kind of boring.
I think we're having trouble with your cell phone connection. Are you still there? Well, I'm going to give my chance here to reintroduce Phil Hands, who is editorial cartoonist for the Wisconsin State Journal. Phil, can you still hear us? We're having a bit of trouble with your cell. Oh, are you still there? Nope, I think we lost you there for a moment with Phil Hands, and he's editorial cartoonist for the Wisconsin State Journal, as we take a look back at political cartoons and his in particular and all of the things that he was able to draw this year. We do have a slideshow, by the way, of his political cartoons at WPR.org/mornings. Phil, are you still there?
I'm still here, I think, yes.
Okay, good, good, good. It was touch and go there for a moment. You know, as you were talking there about drawing people from the street or on the street and just drawing, like, everyday faces, where you get that inspiration from?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a lot better to be caricaturing real people to make them your everyman than to just sort of draw a generic person, because the generic people just sort of start to get boring after a while. So, I you know, I look at Google images of just random people, but it is best to just get out there on the street and draw people for real life, which is something that I like to do when there's not a pandemic going on.
Do you still draw directly on your computer screen?
I do now. Yeah, that's actually one of the biggest changes for the pandemic for me, is that I always preferred drawing my drawing table is at the office at the Wisconsin State Journal, and all my drawing supplies are at the office at the State Journal. But I do have a laptop that I can draw on, a Surface Pro. And since the pandemic started, I've drawn just about every single cartoon on that computer, which has been different for me. It's a different process. It's not quite as creative. You can always go back and hit the Control Z button to fix your latest mistake, which makes you a little obsessive as opposed to just dealing with the lines that exist on the paper.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not as, maybe doesn't feel as good as actually just taking your eraser out and being able to just rub something away.
Yeah, you know, and the thing that's what's really bad is you get into these bad habits, you know, how you, on any sort of iPad or touch screen, you can you sort of push your fingers to get, or apart and zoom in on the screen. And the couple of times I have ended up drawing on paper, I find myself trying to zoom in on the paper with my fingers, which doesn't work in real life.
Yeah. I think we do that with our touch screens and in our mouse. Like, why doesn't this computer work? I'm touching the touch screen here. You know, let's look more at your cartoons and the year that was with the Black Lives Matter protests. And one of your comics features President Trump inside of a tank in front of a person wearing a shirt that says Black Lives Matter. What is the symbolism behind this cartoon?
Well, I was trying to evoke the Tiananmen Square, protests from the 1980s in China. And so I've got, you know, this single solitary Black Lives Matter protester facing down Donald Trump in his tank. And it was about sort of just criticizing the militarized response to the protest movement for freedom in America. So I thought that was sort of a simple, stark image. And, you know, Trump helped a lot by, you know, basically sending in, you know, federalized, militarized troops everywhere. There were massive protests.
How do you interpret the conflict and the conversation surrounding race through your work, through your illustrations?
Well, it is always hard because I come from everything with race as a middle-aged white man, which puts me at a serious disadvantage when it comes to talking about issues of racial justice. I definitely have tried to draw, you know, I think especially in Wisconsin, which is such a state that does not have as much diversity as most states, I have tried to draw more and more African-American and, people of color in my cartoons just to sort of show people that, these are real people that have real lives and real issues. And sometimes there comes into issues of whether a middle-aged white person can have, you know, can I create a African-American cartoon character and then put my words into their mouths? I've had some criticism of doing that over the years. But, I feel like it's important to just have representation in my editorial cartoons. And I've been trying more and more over the years to increase the diversity of my cartoon characters. Because, when I sit down and just sketch out a random default person, it usually looks like me, a pretty boring white middle-aged guy.
When you say that the year has given you a lot of cartoon ideas, where do you see it headed next year? I mean, where will your ideas seize upon?
I think it's going to be a lot more boring next year. At least that's my hope. And that's where I really, I feel like sometimes that's where cartoonists can really thrive, where we just sort of poke fun and point out how ridiculous our politics can be. And it's better to do that when the politics aren't actually literally seriously horribly ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I think it's more fun to do that when you're talking about, I don't know, as boring as it is, talking about, inappropriate budget proposals in the state budget is sometimes better than talking about the threat that the president poses to the democratic norms of our institutions. I feel like, that's maybe a bigger job than what editorial cartoons can do. We can do a good job at that. We point that stuff out. But, boy, I'm looking forward to just, a standard year of politics and politicians, messing up in their own unique, special ways and then pointing out their flaws.
When you look out there among your colleague cartoonists, and there aren't many of you out there, are there particular cartoonists that you look at their work for you to maybe get a laugh, maybe get some inspiration or ideas?
There's one guy I've been reading a lot of. Well, there's a couple of really strong editorial cartoonists. Steve Sack in Minneapolis is a very strong cartoonist. There's a guy from Augusta, Georgia named Rick McKee, who's always been a conservative cartoonist, but in the last 4 years has realized that has decided that Trump is an abomination, and his cartoons are always great to see. You know, a conservative person who also thinks that, you know, what's going on right now is not normal. So that's a cartoonist I always look for in terms of his work. And yeah, I was a big fan of Tom Tolles before he retired from the Washington Post. He was simple and elegant and eloquent at the same time. So those are some really good editorial cartoonists out there.
Phil, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Phil Hands is the editorial cartoonist for the Wisconsin State Journal. You can find a slideshow of his work at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we check in on vaccine rollout with Door County Medical Center in Sturgeon Bay and the additional challenges the hospital faces as a rural healthcare provider. What do you want to know about vaccine distribution in the Door County Peninsula? 800-642-1234. Back after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're checking in on the fight against COVID in the Door Peninsula. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Recall back in the early days of the pandemic when so much was unknown about COVID. This beloved tourism destination was worried about out-of-towners transmitting the virus and part-time residents visiting their cabins. Now, fast forward through the seasons, Door County Medical Center has received its first shipment of the vaccine. Do you live in a rural part of the state? How far away do you live from a hospital? Are you concerned about containing the spread or unclear how sparsely populated areas are prioritized in vaccine distribution? Join in 800-642-1234. Dr. James Heiss is an internist and chief medical officer of the Door County Medical Center in Sturgeon Bay. Dr. Heiss, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. I want to ask, first of all, this shipment you received of the Moderna vaccine, what has this rollout been like for you?
You know, I have to say it's been really smooth. We were looking forward to getting it, and we got our first shipment of 300, and we knew this was coming, and so of course we spent quite a bit of time planning and getting it all set. We knew that our frontline employees were in the priority group 1A, and so we really had a plan. And so I have to say, thanks to our team of folks that got together and organized this, we've gone through the first 300, and we're getting another dose. So we got another shipment of 500 last evening. So we'll be continuing on our vaccinations today, and then after the new year.
So how many do you need to cover all of your staff that you employ?
We have about 725 employees, I believe. So by the time, by the time the day after New Year's happens, we'll be able to vaccinate everyone that wants to be vaccinated.
Yeah, and so some employees may not want to be vaccinated. Do they have a choice of whether or not they receive the vaccine?
Yeah, they do. I mean, that's one of those things that I think all healthcare systems have thought long and hard about. And I think it's one of those things where, because this is a new technology, and I think the vast majority will be getting the vaccine, it's, you know, until you can be certain that you're not going to see some, you know, rare side effect that happens weeks down the road or months down the road, you really don't want to have to mandate it. So thankfully, though, I think, as I say, the vast majority are choosing to get it.
All right. So you've had the 300 shipment, the 500 shipment. Do you know what the future holds for receiving future vaccine shipments?
You know, we don't. I mean, that's one of those things where you assume basically that you're going to be getting shipments weekly. And thus far, that's, you know, in the 2 weeks that it's happened, the last few days, really, that's borne itself out. So I think, you know, in our situation, the numbers that we're looking at are very workable. As far as taking care of our employees, our next steps along with our public health partners is going to be to make sure that the first responders, you know, this group 1B, first responders, police, fire, that sort of thing, that they are also vaccinated. So, I'm actually feeling really good about this, I have to say.
Yeah, so you'll move through the 1A group and get all your employees vaccinated. 1B includes emergency responders, first responders, police, and fire.
Yeah.
How will that work? Will they come to the hospital to get the vaccine? Will those doses be sent directly to their workplaces?
No, it will be basically through either the hospital or our public health department.
Okay.
So they, public health will be managing some of those as well. So we actually, we're very fortunate here in Door County in that we work very closely with our public health department and we have a good relationship. And so we're talking back and forth on a regular basis as to how can we make this smooth for the, you know, that, that category 1B group. And then ultimately thinking ahead toward just community vaccination.
Yeah. In the Moderna vaccine doesn't need that freezer hot, you know, those really
right.
cold freezer temperatures,
right.
unlike the Pfizer vaccine. Are you going to be sticking then with the Moderna, or are there plans to also get the Pfizer?
You know, what's interesting is what we understand to be true is that the state is actually determining who gets what.
Okay.
So the Pfizer vaccine came out first, and because of its ultra-cold temperature that you mentioned, it had to be shipped to hubs. And so that was set up in a hub-and-spoke model. And so the closest hub to us was Green Bay. So at that point, we were waiting to hear, were we going to get some Pfizer or were we going to get Moderna? And as it turned out, we got the Moderna. So my understanding is we're going to be sticking with Moderna. But you know, COVID has been nothing if not a harbinger of change constantly. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, you know, there had been concerns that rural healthcare facilities may be at a disadvantage of not receiving these vaccines in a timely manner. It sounds like that hasn't been the case for you.
Yeah, I would say that's true. You know, and it's funny, initially when the Pfizer vaccine was being distributed around Green Bay, we were all kind of, you know, waiting with bated breath and hoping to get the vaccine. And initially, you know, we did. I mean, you're human. You know, you had some thoughts of, boy, I think we're being forgotten here. But then when you look back now that here we are after Christmas and everything, you think, well, you know, it was about 24 hours or 48 hours between, you know, and I guess it was more like a week, but nonetheless, by the time things were shipped, it really wasn't a big deal. So, you know, if I'm honest with myself, it really was fine, and I don't feel as though we were at any great disadvantage.
When you look at your staff, how have your medical teams responded in receiving a vaccine?
So far, there's been a lot of great enthusiasm. I mean, we've had, you know, we were able to, we went through the first, you know, 300. We got our first 300 doses. I want to say it was the 23rd of December. So, you know, we did some initial vaccinations that day. We did some on Christmas Eve and then right after, on a Saturday after Christmas. And so we ran through the 300 by, I want to say, Monday or Tuesday of this week. Now we've gotten more into last evening.
Yeah, now you'll probably, with that batch, have to start thinking about when that second dose is delivered.
Well, we think about it right away. I mean,
okay.
I was because my clinical practice is as a hospitalist at our hospital, so I am I take care of COVID patients, and so I was one of the first to get the vaccine here as well. And so I know I'm getting mine on the 20th. So on Inauguration Day, I get my second dose. And so immediately you set the date for when that second dose happens.
Have you, when you got your first dose, did you notice anything?
Not at all.
No.
That was the thing, is I didn't even feel the injection. And, you know, I think initially I thought, boy, you know, I hope I got it. I mean, geez, I felt fine. And then later in the evening, my arm hurt a little bit. And the way I looked at that is, hey, that's a great thing. And now I know I got it. But that was the limit of what I experienced.
We're talking with Dr. James Heiss, who is Chief Medical Officer of the Door County Medical Center in Sturgeon Bay. Do you live in a rural part of the state? How far away do you live from a hospital? What concerns do you have about getting the vaccine? What do you want to know about the challenges of COVID in a sparsely populated area? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Heiss, as you say, you're a hospitalist. What have you been seeing in the hospital with the number of patients being treated for COVID?
Currently, we actually have had a little bit of a downtick, which is a good thing. I think right now I've got three or four in the hospital. And now we at Door County Medical Center, we are a critical access hospital, which means by definition we have 25 licensed beds, which if you live in a city, it doesn't sound like much. I know I came from the Milwaukee area and I didn't know hospitals came this small but before I moved up here 10 years ago. But in a community our size, that you know, with a population of 30,000, that actually suits the area just fine. So I think the maximum we had in the hospital at our peak, at our surge, if you will, was, I think it was about 10 patients, you know, which for us is a pretty significant number. But right now, as I say, we're three or four and we're doing pretty well.
There was such a concern early on in the pandemic that people from out of town were going to spread the virus in the tourist areas. Has that become less of an issue?
You know, I don't know that it, thankfully, actually, I don't know that it ever really was a huge, which is good. I mean, the spikes in cases that we've had have sort of gone along with what other population centers have seen. You know, we saw in the summertime, late summer, we saw gatherings, weddings, things like that, that tended to become spreader events. And then we saw result of that, and we saw a little bit after Thanksgiving, but not too much, and so now we'll see what happens with Christmas.
What about access to testing? How often are your staff able to get tested?
You know, we are not doing a regular screening testing. We have not set that up. We, you know, we do have the ability to do that, but we just haven't found that to be necessary. Following CDC guidelines. And so, you know, our testing for the public, we've been very fortunate in that, you know, I guess one of the things that I'm really proud of here is that because we're a smaller institution, we are able to really turn on the dime, and we were on top of this from the get-go. And so that's something that I'll be proud of until my career is done. But we've always been able to test the community. We've decided not to test everybody. We're not testing asymptomatics here in town. We're able to get turnaround times of about 12 hours for anyone that comes in, for all comers. And so that's a pretty neat thing.
Yeah. And do you feel like you have enough tests in the community now in order to get people tested quickly?
I do. At this point, we actually have ramped up our capacity. About 2-3 months ago, we got a second analyzer, so we have three analyzers of two different tests, both of which are PCR, and we're able to get things turned around. So again, pretty impressive for a small hospital.
And explain the difference between the PCR and the rapid antigen.
Yeah, the PCR test actually picks up basically DNA signature or RNA signature in the case of the virus itself. So if it's there at all, it will amplify and pick up that virus, and so you'll know it's there. Whereas the antigen test is not the same technology, but with PCR we know it to be very, very sensitive, but also very specific, which means that it will not pick up other tests or other bugs.
We're talking with Dr. James Heiss, who's Chief Medical Officer of the Door County Medical Center in Sturgeon Bay. Do you live in the Door Peninsula? What questions do you have about access to rapid antigen testing, the PCR testing, in-hospital medical care for COVID, and when the vaccine will reach you? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Dr. James Heiss. He's Chief Medical Officer for Door County Medical Center in Sturgeon Bay, and he's been briefing us on his hospital status and treating COVID patients in his vaccine distribution. He's answering your questions about quarantine, about isolation, testing, treatment, and he's with us for 10 more minutes. Still time to talk at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Karen now in Madison. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to ask?
Hi. I'm probably one of the later tiers to get the vaccine because I'm a younger, non-emergency worker. But I'm curious because you have an EpiPen because I have very severe nut reactions. I've never had any reactions to any medications or vaccines in the past, but I have been reading that it is a rare concern with allergic reactions. And I'm just curious how concerned should I be about that? And are vaccination sites prepared if these reactions happen?
Karen, thank you for that. Dr. Heiss?
Karen, that's a great question. First, I'll answer the last part first. Yes, all the sites that are our vaccinators, they're set up to be prepared if something happens. Generally speaking, with any new vaccine, we watch every patient for about 15 minutes afterward, you know, which would be the same thing even if this was the first time you got a flu shot. Now, as for the fact that you have an EpiPen and you've had allergic reactions to things, what the CDC and what the companies themselves have said is that if unless you've had a reaction, a severe reaction to an injectable medication or to another vaccine itself, you should be okay. It's a situation where if it's a food allergy or things like that that have caused problems, there should not be an issue with the vaccine. One of the things that I'm a pragmatist, and what I would tell you is just bring your EpiPen along. Not that the places that are the places that you would go to will have the capability, but you know what, an EpiPen is way easier.
Karen, thank you for that question. Dr. Heiss, there has also been questions surrounding the vaccine and breastfeeding women. What do you know there?
You know, I know that there has this. It was not tested in that
cohort.
Group, and
uh-huh.
So right. And so initially, the CDC was saying that they would recommend not. However, my understanding is the American College of Gynecology came out and said, no, it probably is okay. But what I always do, you know, as a good internal medicine doc, is I always say, hey, you know what, I don't take care of the childbearing women for the most part. Yeah, so by all means, check with your obstetrician gynecologist and get the advice from them.
Well, let's talk about how treatment protocols in the hospital have changed for patients who do come in and need hospitalization, need treatment for their COVID symptoms. What have you seen in the evolution of care?
Well, you know, early on there was this conversation about hydroxychloroquine and whether or not that was effective, and that was pretty quickly determined not to be an effective treatment. And, you know, like anything else, if it had zero side effects, you'd say, well, what's the big deal? But there can be side effects and there can be consequences. And since that time, we've gone to an antiviral called remdesivir. We've done convalescent plasma, which is plasma that has been donated by people who have had COVID and has antibodies within it. And then also the use of an age-old medicine called dexamethasone, which is a steroid. And so pretty much everyone that comes in, that's those are the three things that if they meet the criteria, which in general has to do with whether your oxygen level is low, they would get those three things. As everything in this virus so far, you look at the studies, there's not a lot of data that says that remdesivir or convalescent plasma does anything. However, there doesn't seem to be a big downside. So, you know, when someone comes in and they're just not able to breathe, you want to try and do what you can. And just anecdotally, we've seen some success with these medications. But again, it's just anecdotal.
We're talking with Dr. James Heiss, who is Chief Medical Officer of the Door County Medical Center in Sturgeon Bay, and talking about the rollout of the vaccine in a rural area and also treatment for COVID in sparsely populated areas. 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Jill now in Madison. Hi, Jill.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to just go off of like the last person who called, and I work with internal medicine providers. One of my providers is pregnant. She is all excited about getting the vaccine. She did a lot of research, and she felt like it would be okay to get it, even though the rest of us are like, oh, my God, don't do that. And another thing is we have patients who, oh, God, the term is slipping my mind, but that red meat protein allergy, and the COVID vaccine has a small, tiny, minute trace of that same kind of protein. But we're telling our patients, letting them know that it's so small that
it won't be
right.
harmful or cause spur
exactly.
an allergic reaction. Dr. Heiss?
Yeah, I'm not aware of that last part about red meat protein allergies, but yeah, I mean it sounds like the approach you're taking is a really good one, you know, from the perspective of you know, unless there's a real reason not to get it, you know, we're really really recommending people get this because that's how we're going to generate herd immunity and be able to get past this. And so obviously we don't want people taking the vaccine that shouldn't, you know, those groups that haven't been studied, they haven't been studied in kids yet. But boy, I couldn't wait to stick my arm out just because, you know, nothing else so far has been all that effective. And so I'm very, very hopeful this is going to take care of this for us.
Yeah. Jill, thank you for the call. going back to how you treat patients in the hospital, there was early on the ventilator situation, the shortage of ventilators we saw on the East Coast. What was your approach, or has been your approach, to using ventilators?
You know, we have not had to use ventilators once, which, you know, I think is just a fluke. But what thankfully, our initial three patients that were very sick and otherwise might have ended up on ventilators, they both were very clear at the beginning of their course they did not want to be placed on ventilators. And so we managed to take care of them with non-invasive ventilation, so BiPAP and high-flow oxygen, things like that. And so we actually kind of were learning, as everyone else was, that it turns out that trying to keep people off ventilators, if you can, makes the most sense. Early on, there was the conversation that let's get people ventilated so that we can try and rest the lungs. Well, it turned out pretty quickly that that actually wasn't the best choice. So we never had an issue. We were very fortunate, though, up here, again, being in a remote area, we had 9 ventilators, you know, and there's a lot of critical access hospitals that are lucky they have 1. So the problem never was, the concern never was the number of ventilators. The concern was, do we have the staff to be able to actually manage those?
Yeah. How has staffing been for you? Have you had a lot of staff out?
Yeah, I think we've had about 50 that tested positive and were out. Currently, we have very few. I think we're in the single digits. So, you know, when everything was surging, that's when our employee positive surged as well. We've been lucky, knock on wood. I mean, we certainly have been spread thin, but we've been able to get through it.
What about PPE? Have you had enough PPE, access to the personal protective equipment?
Yeah, we have. I mean, you know, it sounds like I'm trying to paint a big rosy picture to everything, but it's just the reality up here is our supply chain folks have just been pros from the get-go. They actually saw that this was coming, and they ordered a bunch of stuff. And so, you know, we don't have stockpiles of it, but we've never really been what other people are experiencing in other cities where they've had to reuse masks. We've never been in that situation. So really thankful about that.
Well, as vaccines continue to roll out, you know, people who don't work in healthcare are just asking that question, when will this pandemic end? What do you see in the future in 2021?
Well, you know, my hope is, if everything goes well, I think that if we can get a large percentage of people to become vaccinated so that we can reach that herd immunity, and there's always some debate as to, it sounds like it's about 80% people vaccinated. If we can reach that herd immunity, the idea would be not so much that you're gonna decimate COVID and get rid of it, but you would get it to the point where it's like influenza or some other illness where, yeah, it's around, but it's around in very small pockets. And so we can all proceed with our lives without having to wear masks and do all this distancing and things like that. But we can just tamp down those individual cases. So my hope is we'll get there in the summertime. We'll see.
Dr. Heiss, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. James Heiss is Chief Medical Officer for Door County Medical Center in Sturgeon Bay. Just ahead, we say goodbye to 2020 as what a year it's been. A philosopher tells us what we can learn from the pandemic, ongoing racial inequities, and a bitter presidential election. Are you feeling philosophical about 2020? Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.